session number 12585, Real One.
Mr. Clayton, Real One. Were you born in York?
Yes.
Which year was that?
1919.
What did your father do for a living?
Well, he worked in a chocolate factory.
Where did you go to school?
Poppleton Road School and then the Manor School.
How old were you when you left?
14.
To do what?
Well, at first I went to work in the big chocolate factory, Roundtree's. And I left there at the age of 16 to go to Gravesend Sea School. And after having been in the Merchant Navy for a year, I worked on the local boats going to Hull and Goole for cement and sand and gravel. Now, that got me familiar with the crane unloading. And at the time that the crane man died, and I was 18 at that time, the chief of the firm asked me to take over the crane, and I learnt that job. And I loved driving the big steam crane, an overhead steam travelling crane, unloading the boats at the quay, the jetty.
What were you doing when war broke out?
Well, I was a crane driver. And, of course, if I'd been working in the docks, I suppose it would have been a reserved occupation. But as my main job was unloading coal and cement and gravel, this was more in the nature of the building trade. And, of course, it was not, in effect, as it happens, that conscription was announced, you know, in 1939, and it applied to all youths who attained the age of 20 that particular year. And this included me. And I signed for the Navy, having sea experience. But I received papers for the Royal Marines. So I decided to go and try to insist on sea service, which didn't really work, because although I made strong objections, the adjutant told me that I was a member of this big division, the MNBDO, the Mobile Naval Base Defence Organisation. And as he put it to me, to use his actual words, that I would never leave the shores of England. And that seemed odd to me, really, but I decided to settle for that, and only half believing it. So this was a very large organisation. It included searchlights, signals, and almost everything imaginable, artillery and anti-aircraft. And my unit was an anti-aircraft battery. The first one was the 21st Light Attack Battery. And this one, this battery went to Norway, and we lost all our guns. However, I didn't go to Norway, the battery did. I had to stay back, for I had a job as a telephonist. And there was a lot of secrets, information regarding the radar and a lot of codes that had to be learned. And I had to teach this to the unit that replaced us. We were at South Shields at this time. So four of us stayed back, and all the rest went to Norway. And the guns were lost. The men returned, all but two.
This is the spring of 1940 we're talking
the
about.
The spring of 1940. And only two men were lost. So the survivors formed a new anti-aircraft battery, the 23rd, with Bofors. And from then on, we took the Bofors to various different locations. And we had special Bofors training. Predictors, and I went to Portsmouth for 3 weeks to train up in diesel engines for generators to produce electricity for predictors. But in the event, neither predictors nor generators went to Crete, so I was in effect a spare man, you see. But however, I was an officer's orderly, you see. So I was not needed on the guns. Not initially.
Were you in any anti-aircraft defence in Britain against the bombing?
Well, very early in the war. We had our guns on the northeast coast, South Shields, North Shields, Blyth, and that area, and we were in action against with these Leitakak against the mine layers that were coming in low, and they were laying mines in the Tyne, and then later in the Tees. I was at Redcar at Teesmouth, the big steelworks, Dorman Long. And but we had 3-inch guns there.
Did you hit any of the mine layers?
We hit one in Redcar. Now my gun couldn't be credited because actually everything opened fire. Machine guns and everything, but this plane was very low and it was quite invisible, but there was this such enormous sound that everything, all the fire was directed toward the sound, and tracers were going out until suddenly there was an enormous orange flash, and that was a direct hit.
So this was in 39?
40. Early in 40.
Could you see the mines being dropped?
No. Not usually, no.
Were they slow planes or fast?
Well, I would say that they were medium planes. And they were not coming in numbers. More in odd ones.
And that was the only time you were in action against enemy aircraft in Britain?
Well, we were in action at South Shields. But our guns there were single barrel pom-poms. Now, they were very old. They were from the First War, and the ammunition was very old. And these are the guns that were lost in Norway. And I think our men were ashamed to leave them behind, and for the condition they were in. And, you know, it was no advert for Britain. The ammunition was so poor. We hit one plane and the ammunition went straight through the fuselage and should have exploded on impact. So those guns were pretty useless. But of course, the other batteries around us, the heavy attack was very, very good. But planes coming in low, our guns were not very effective. These single barrel pom-poms, Vickers, 2-inch pom-poms, they were not very good at all.
So you didn't take part in counteracting the Blitz?
Not really, no. The northeast coast was not much affected, for we had we had men living in London who would go home on leave and tell us all about what it was like down there. And of course, this was different altogether, for the northeast coast was not heavily attacked.
In the summer of 1940 and the autumn of 1940, when the big invasion scare was on, did you think that the Germans would get across?
Well, I didn't really think they would get across. I knew there was a danger of it. But for some reason, I thought that they would halt. I thought they would have to halt. And of course, the men had been saved. You see, the army at Dunkirk had been largely saved, having lost most of the equipment. I was at Blandford at that time, and we were training at Blandford. We were on Beaufort training there. This was a very big camp in Dorset, and the camp housed many thousands of men from Dunkirk, quite a lot of whom were French. But I don't think our unit was much worried about an invasion. We didn't seem to think that, I suppose, this was just a feeling of maybe overconfidence. But I never worried really about an invasion.
Did you hear Churchill's speeches on the wireless?
Yes.
What effect did they have?
Well, they really boosted men's morale, and troops used to go around singing the patriotic songs, "There'll Always Be an England," and that one in particular. And I think morale was so high, despite what success the Germans had in France, morale was really high.
So you didn't think the war was going to be lost?
No, we didn't. I mean, all these demoralised men, they seemed to be demoralised. Most of them had lost their small arms. They'd lost the weapons, most of them. And a lot of them were ragged. But they didn't really seem to be demoralised. But in spite of that, we had a very high morale. We just regarded the men as exhausted rather than being demoralised. These exhausted men, they weren't really demoralised.
How did you go to Crete?
We left on an enormous convoy. I was at Derby at that time. And I'd heard the bombing of Coventry, and I was sent on Christmas leave, and directly after that, well, it was embarkation leave, but it was at Christmas time.
You mean you could hear the bombing of Coventry from Derby, or you mean you heard about it?
We heard the rumbling from Derby. We heard the bombing taking place.
All the way from Coventry to Derby?
Yes, we could hear the rumbling because the raid was out of the ordinary in size, we wondered until reports, we wondered which town had been hit, and it turned out to be Coventry.
Sorry, I interrupted you with you telling me how you got to Crete.
Yes. Straight after embarkation leave, which was at Christmas, we were sent to Glasgow to join a convoy. And this was an enormous convoy. We were 2 or 3 days in Glasgow while the convoy was all being assembled in the big Firth of Clyde, is it? Near the Mull of Kintyre, the big convoy was assembling. And it must have been one of the biggest of the war, an enormous convoy. Ever so many ships. And it was very cold. And it was very stormy. We had to sail directly westward to get away from any danger of aircraft if the weather was clear. So we sailed directly westward, but straight into the teeth of an enormous gale. And thousands of the men had never been at sea before. Most of the men had not been at sea before. And all of them were seasick. And of course it was terrible in the toilets. The toilets were adapted, you see, for in order to take such a lot of troops. It had been the vessel had been a passenger ship, but not to carry such a lot of men as, and it had been adapted in other ways. Enormous water tanks had been fitted to have to cope with such a lot of troops. And this particular storm was very, very severe, and the new water tanks were smashed, and the storm was so fierce. So, as I said before, almost all the men were seasick, and I had comrades wishing to die, literally wishing they could die. The weather was so severe. And personally, I wasn't so affected. I'd been in the Merchant Navy. I'd been around Cape Horn. And so I used to take my closest friends, take them amidships. That's an effect like the middle of a seesaw. It's free of all the pitching and tossing. And they would stay there a few hours, and I would take them sandwiches. But they couldn't stay there so long because the cold was so intense. So I used to help them back again. And but this storm must have lasted approximately a week. And by that time, the ship started to sail southwards, and the weather improved. And we sailed south for quite a time, and then eastwards in very nice weather. So, in fact, tropical weather or subtropical. And we put in at Freetown, Sierra Leone, for supplies and water. The convoy was massive, and going in zigzags, and it seemed to be very slow. We had cruisers and a battleship, an aircraft carrier, and many destroyers.
Did you meet the enemy on the way?
No, never. No action at all.
Which ship were you in?
Now, my ship was the Bergen Fjord. It was a very big Norwegian ship. And the captain the captain made it plain to us that his ship had not been captured by the British. He'd sailed voluntarily into Glasgow to offer his services to Britain. But subsequently, this is digressing a little, but subsequently, and it's an enormous coincidence, when I was a POW and on the first farm that I got onto, the farmer's wife explained, and being the first farmer, I didn't speak so well at that time, but she made it plain to me in Pidgin that her son was in the German army and he was serving in Norway. And she said, I'll bring you a picture of his troop ship. And she brought a picture of the Oslo Fjord, and it was the sister ship to the Bergen Fjord. And I thought this was fabulous, and if only I could have produced Bergen Fjord picture, which I lost on Crete. If I could have shown her that one and put the two together, I lost the opportunity to do that, and not being able to explain it all to her.
Did you also stop in South Africa?
Yes, Cape Town and Durban. We stayed a week in Cape Town and 3 weeks in Durban. And that was very, very enjoyable. Very nice. Then we went northward towards Aden. We stopped at Aden for supplies.
Where did you arrive in Egypt?
We arrived in Egypt, in Port Tewfik, on the southern end of the Suez Canal.
And how long were you in Egypt before you went to Crete?
A matter of 3 or 4 weeks.
How did it come about that you went to Crete?
Well, I think originally we were destined for action in the desert. But apparently the Secret Service had given such information about the impending invasion of Crete, and the MNBDO having just arrived on this large convoy, two and two would add together that they would be ideally suitable as reinforcements for Crete, because the forces there were actually people who had evacuated from Greece, you see, and they were not well equipped. While the MNBDO was a powerful unit which should have contributed, did actually contribute well to the defence of Crete. So the whole unit went, and this was, really, I don't know how many men, but it would run into, I shouldn't really guess, maybe 2,000 or 3,000, a couple of thousand.
Do you know the month that you went to Crete in?
Yes, in May. The invasion was the 20th of May, and we arrived there about 8 or 9 days before that. We sailed from Alexandria on a large troop ship called the New Zealand, spelt in the Dutch fashion, and it was a Dutch ship, N-I-E-U-W, Zeeland, they would pronounce it. This was a fast ship, and there were only about 3 or 4 ships in this convoy, but they were all big and fast. And we landed at Suda Bay, and Suda Bay was being bombed.
When you landed?
Just before we landed. And we actually got away with it safely. We were able to disembark during a lull in the bombing. At other times, Many troops were lost there during the bombing. The bombing was very heavy there. The Germans were concentrating on Souda Bay. And quite a number of ships there were bombed. They were sunk and beached, some with just the masts showing and some with the superstructure showing. And of course, the big cruiser York, you know. The York had been sunk maybe 6 weeks before that time by the Italians. They came into Souda Bay with very, very fast torpedo boats, small speed boats, and the whole boat was aimed at this ship, and the man would dive overboard just in time to save himself. And they had this success. They hit the cruiser York, and she was quite disabled, and had to beach herself on the shore at Souda Bay.
What happened to you on disembarkation?
We disembarked in Souda Bay, and it was necessary to get well away from the shore, which was being heavily bombed. So we went inland a little, a distance. And we took cover cover from view in olive groves until there was some decision about where we should go. For my battery, I only know about my own battery, of course. For the other units, I had no idea where they went, searchlights and signals and various. But my own battery consisted of four troops, A, B, C, and headquarters troop. I belonged to A troop, and A troop was designated for Malamé, and we moved off on transports to Malamé. But I did hear where the other troops went. That B troop went to Rethymnon, and C troop went to Heraklion, and headquarters troops stayed in the Souda Bay area between Souda Bay and Hania. So we had six Bofors, you see. We had two at Malamé, and two at Heraklion, and two at Rethymnon.
Can you describe the place that you went to in Malamé?
Yes. So you see, Crete had three landing areas, landing strips, and one was at Malamé, and one at Rethymnon, and one at Heraklion. And we had been told